I find that women are less likely to apply, but not less likely to get hired. But as soon as it's a very big vertical move, like going to a position that requires leadership, there are really big gender differences. And so like a lot of my research tries to understand what is it about leadership that today seems to be less appealing to a lot of women compared to men.
Welcome to Get Inspired, your podcast to feel connected, empowered, and inspired by real-world role models and their stories of managing parenthood with successful careers. Today, we're talking to Dr. Ingrid Hegele, an economist at MIT and LMU Munich, whose research into gender differences in corporate settings tells us a lot about how we can fix some of those imbalances. I'm going to hand over now to the host of this podcast, Ricarda Engelmeier, the founder of My Collective.
Welcome at My Collective, Ingrid. It's great to have you here.
Thanks for having me.
We already had a talk about what we're going to speak about today. And one of the most interesting parts in our conversation and also in the couple of studies that I've read from you was that you were focusing in your work in the field of labor economy on demystifying the myth circulating about, for example, gender gap, a topic that we quite often focus on here in My Collective. And I was wondering if you could fill us in a little bit. Why are there so many myths? What are the myths? And in specific, why are there so many myths in the area of a gender gap?
Yeah, so I mean, as a researcher, whenever we talk about gender differences in the workplace, and I think also when you read the newspaper, when you talk to your friends, we often think about glass ceilings. I'm not sure if anyone of you know why we call it the glass ceiling, but in 1980, the Wall Street Journal came out with this one magazine that had a pretty crazy illustration on the cover. It was a woman in a pencil skirt on high heels, standing on a tiny desk and pressing her face at the glass ceiling. And the illustration was so, captivating, also, playing with this female stereotype of pencil skirt and, an assistant in the high heels, that it really caught on. And everybody was talking about the glass ceiling. And not only, like in magazines, but also a lot of politicians. So over 12 countries in the EU have established gender quotas for board members. So it's really like a lot of the attention among politicians, but also about researchers has been really focused at the very top of the job ladder, trying to break the glass ceilings. And, this is really important. I mean, in Germany, we all know, we had a female chancellor, and there was a really important point, right? Me growing up, that there's a woman who can rise to the highest office in Germany. That is really important. But, there's been lots of hope that once you break the glass ceiling, it'll trickle down. And there's been quite a lot of evidence, for example, from a board quota in Norway or similar law in Italy, that hasn't happened. So even if those laws, they're pretty effective at increasing the female shares at the very top, it doesn't change, female shares at lower levels. It doesn't change how girls think about their career in school. It doesn't change how women select into majors in college. So it means it's like focusing at the very top alone is not enough. And, I think all of us know these examples. For example, Angela Merkel, seeing someone who's extremely successful and very different than yourself isn't always the most effective role model, right? If she can do it, it doesn't mean that an average woman in Germany can do it. And I think as an economist, it's kind of tempting because it's really hard to measure things. It's hard to know, if you ask companies, how many women do you have at certain levels? It's really hard to answer this question. There's very little data and there's very little monitoring. So if you ask a company, how many women do you have on your board? Everybody can answer that. You probably have a good sense, how many leaders in Europe are female. But do you know how many local politicians are female? That's really tricky. And how do you define the different hierarchy levels? And then even if you would know, we would be able to measure, what do you do with it? As a company, you can send every senior executive to a special workshop. You can pay a lot of money, you can get, but if you want to do this for every female talent at lower levels, that's really expensive. It's really hard to do. So there are lots of practical reasons that explain why we focused at the very top. What I'm trying to show in my research is that that is not enough. And there are many reasons why it's really important to focus at lower levels, both because that's how you reach women, but also I find that making this first step in the job ladder really changes differences between men and women. So helping a couple of women early on has an impact the entire career afterwards.
So there are two parts that I'm really intrigued about. So one is you're saying it's not enough. And on the other side, you're saying focusing on lower levels. So this non-enough part, is it, does that mean that we don't need the quota, or does it mean we need the quota, but it's just not enough? Or what's your take on the effect of the quota itself? So there is an effect, but only at the top level, and the trickle down is missing, but you still need it, I guess, right?
It depends what your objectives are. So I think quotas, it's very clear these quotas are extremely effective at increasing the female share at the level they're targeting. So if your objective is to get more women into boards, the quotas are extremely effective. If you believe that, you know, more diverse boards make better decisions, that is great. If you thought that getting more women into boards increases female shares across the job ladder, then that doesn't happen. Very often, HR policies are motivated by that start at the top, and there's going to be a trickle-down effect because people are going to see, and then, you know, we'll target the top and we kind of rely on that. And so I think it really, the goal is, and, you know, pipelines are a huge problem. Like lots of large organizations now they've promoted everyone they could to the senior executive level to comply with these quotas, but there's no one coming after that. Like, you know, the pipeline is empty.
So does it mean that you would have to have a quota at every single level if quotas are so effective on the levels that they're targeting?
I think it depends. Everything comes with a cost and a benefit. I think what I find in my research, it's not so much about, you can think about, you know, promotions as there is a push and a pull. Like, is it that women don't want the promotions, or is it hiring managers don't want to grant promotions? What I find when I study a lot of organizations, it's really about this, women don't apply as much for promotions, but not because women don't, you know, are not interested or they don't want these, but because the status quo, how these jobs are designed, is less attractive to them. So in my research, what you're imposing would, you know, you would impose a quota if you think it's really about the hiring side, right? These hiring managers like will never hire women. We need to force them. What I find is that a lot of this gender gap is just driven from the supply side. These women choose not to apply, for example, because the jobs that are management positions right now come with crazy hours, with a lot of traveling. We talk about leadership, you know, very male dominated. So, you know, there are different levers to pull. I'm convinced that a very effective level, and also a very democratic level, is to think about the supply side. Now, what can we do to make it more attractive for women to apply? Currently, it really doesn't seem that the hiring side is very the restrictive one. So it doesn't seem that we really need the quota, you know, across the job ladder, but that is just a different approach. It depends on your objectives. It depends on the organization.
So when you talk about applications, which part is it that you are focusing on? Is it the way the applications are phrased, or the way they are published, or the way they're perceived by the potential employees?
So I think one part is maybe to even start earlier on. So I often study internal career progression in organizations. And especially when we talk about gender differences, there's so many things that could go on, right? It's really hard to pinpoint what is it. It could be discrimination, it could be bias, it could be men and women have different jobs. So one thing I do is basically an accounting exercise. I see women are less likely to get promoted to the first level. What is it? And I find that women are less likely to apply, but not less likely to get hired. So then you can look at, like, you know, under which circumstances do women apply? So I look at the job ads, how it's phrased, also the job features, like, is it flexible? Does it require business travel? Does it require negotiation on the job? I look at the composition of the team. Is it very male dominated? Who's the manager? I also look, you know, would it require you to relocate, to commute, to learn a new task? And what I find is that there are very few gender differences when it comes to lateral moves. Women are super curious. They are as interested in, you know, new challenges, like going to a new functional area, going to a new division. But as soon as it's a very big vertical move, like going to a position that requires leadership, leadership over a team, there are really big gender differences. And so, like, a lot of my research tries to leverage them to understand what is it about leadership that today seems to be less appealing to a lot of women compared to men.
I guess, one of the main topics that is always discussed is mobility as a kind of showstopper, right? Is that the case? Is mobility the one and only showstopper, or is it, and how do you tackle that if that's the case?
That's a good question. I myself am a vegetarian. And so when I go to a restaurant in Munich, for example, sometimes you think that I'm not hungry because I will order a potato salad because they only have meat dishes. And so I think about this, like about the jobs, like going to a restaurant. Like sometimes you see women don't apply and you think maybe they don't have an appetite to be a leader. They don't have an appetite for a career, but maybe they're just not interested in that combination that's offered on the menu. So what I do is I basically disentangle the different job features. And it's really difficult to really measure, right? Because leadership positions also have more pay, they have less flexibility, they have bigger teams. So to pinpoint what it is. And one thing we did, we surveyed like 30,000 workers at this really big company in Germany. And we asked them, like, where would you like to see yourself in 5 years? And a really big point was that women were less likely to want to do leadership responsibility. But when you ask them, they often say, you know, yeah, I would like to, but I'm not sure what about the hours, if I have to work overtime, what if something happens on Thursday night and I need to figure it out? What if there's a pushback by the team? But then we asked a lot of women who just recently made this first big step, and a lot of them are saying, you know, I wasn't sure if I liked it. And then I tried it out and I realized I'm actually good at this. Because very often managers are much more male than female. So if you just look around and you're like, maybe this is not a good job for women, because clearly the other women didn't choose to get this job. So I think a lot of our research is really influenced by these women saying, I wasn't sure and I tried it out and I actually really like leading a team. And a lot of these, you know, characteristics that leaders have, we often talk about leaders in a much more male leaning language, right? That you have to be authoritative, you have to make these decisions, you have to be tough. But then these women are like, oh, you have to be super empathetic, you have to be a good team player, you have to be good at communicating. So I think a lot of that is uncertainty to apply to something that you don't know. But then looking back, you know, a lot of women actually discover they're pretty good at this and they really like leading a team.
So what can companies do? I guess there are a couple of things that you can do in terms of, I don't know, phrasing the job differently or actually creating different types of jobs. But what did your research show? I mean, 30,000 people and a company, they must have had some solutions for this. Can you give some advice for companies who do want to tackle that problem?
Yeah, I think there again, you can look at about push and pull factors. So push factor is, do women feel, you know, comfortable applying? So I find in my research that men and women have really different application thresholds. Like women care much more about a good relationship with their manager. They feel much more it's disloyal to leave the team. And they put much more weight on supervisor's approval and, you know, saying you should apply. So I think at the stage of when men and women don't really know what the job brings, men are much more likely to just apply and women are just much more, you know, careful. These are just human differences that we find in, like, you know, there's behavioral evidence in many different settings. But when we think about application systems that are built to empower everyone to drive their own career, they can really magnify. So companies can, and I do work with some companies that could, you know, think about workshops to support employees. And, you know, you could support both male and female employees, but I would guess that the impact on female employees would be much larger. Just really empower them. Maybe talk about what does it mean to get rejected? You know, applications are just a normal part. Like, this is how you get a job. If you don't get it, that's okay. Like, a lot of these things that women seem to be more worried about because they're more worried about these social interactions than men on average.
So from what I understand, so you would say women are applying only for those jobs where they say, I'm 100% certain that I can do it and I really want this type of job. And men would go crisscross applying everywhere. But that kind of actually sort of works out better.
Exactly.
How does that work from the, what would you be your suggestions then for men and women when applying? Is that the suggestion that everybody should go crisscross and apply everywhere?
So I always bring up this example of playing poker. So there are just like many differences between male and female behavior that people have studied in labs. And so one difference is if you have men and women play poker in a lab, men on average lose much more money. Because they're just much more risk-loving and women kind of know when to stop. So women are much better sometimes to, you know, have a good sense about risk. So in the lab, if you ask me who does it right or who does it better, male or men or women, it's clearly women. In application systems, we don't have this disciplining force. We don't have the force that says, if you apply again, you'll lose money. So basically the strategy of that men use more often than women to just apply all over the place, and that's what I see in my data, it actually kind of works out. So, you know, I think in a sense that applications are not that costly. And honestly, many firms are trying to get more applicants, not less applicants. I think just encouraging women and just maybe having an extra support, talking about it, it's okay to apply. And you know, if supervisors can always do that, maybe HR can do it, maybe there can be a mentoring system. You would even think about like an automated application system where, you know, everybody applies every 6 months or something like that. Such systems would actually reduce the gender gaps because men right now apply much more than women.
So basically applying as much as possible and then also being able to actually choose on your side in a way.
Yeah. And so I think the other thing you asked me, you know, what can companies do? So this is the push factor. You can also think about the pull factor, like how do we design jobs? So one strategy is to change job ads. It's been really popular in the last 5 years. And you know, there is some evidence that, you know, if job ads are very phrased, very competitively, but there's also some evidence from really large firms. I think, for example, Uber, if you phrase a job ad less competitively, both men and women, like less qualified candidates will apply because it will sound like a less good job. So, you know, it's really not just about phrasing the job ad. It's really also about the job features that are behind. Like, is there really a job flexibility option? Do you really, like, I think you can think about this. If you require 50% business travel in Europe, you cannot have competitive language, but it's probably not that attractive to women with like small children. So in my research, I really find it's really about these real job features. And, you know, it is about hours, but it's also about, for example, leading a team. Can you as a company maybe add a hierarchy level where people can try out being a team leader with a small team of, you know, 2 or 3 people, not 20 people? Or can you adjust some of these things so it seems less scary or more manageable? Could you, for example, if someone's on parental leave, could you offer someone else the chance to just try out being a leader for the 12 months that they're replacing someone on parental leave and then just decide if they want to do this or if they want to go back to their old job?
Yeah, this is actually a topic that we quite often talk about. It's sort of innovative, fluid work models that you could work around through your parental leave to actually not see it as a sort of end of your career, but actually as a career booster. And one very innovative approach is to actually make someone sit on the job while you are on parental leave. And then when you come back, have a bit of a handholder, and that person who's been sitting on that job actually gains some experience at a certain level and can then move on from there. So I think that's a really interesting way of seeing it and also promoting it. But this leads me to our last question, parenting skills. So we are very much focusing on converting parenting skills into leadership skills. And I would be intrigued, which parenting skills did you see in your research turning into leadership skills most often?
That's a good question. A lot of my research is about how managers affect workers and firms. And one thing I find is that it's really hard for managers, like managers have a conflict of interest because many organizations rely on managers to identify talented workers, but they're not compensated for that. So you're supposed to find good people, help them to get promoted, push them to move on, but then you have to replace them, don't know how, maybe you can't get a rehire, etc. So there's like this phenomenon of managers trying to hoard good people that have promoted them. And I feel like one thing that parents are pretty good at is at letting go and learning at letting go. And so I think as a manager, it's also, you feel like you've invested in these people and now it's your right, you know, to benefit from it. But I think it's also really important to think and believe in the people and really know when to let go. And so I think that's a really great leadership skill.
That's a great parenting skill and leadership skill. Thank you so much for being with us. And it was great. We could have talked on and on for hours. I would like to invite you to stay with us for a discussion in our group, but would like to thank you and say goodbye here for our interview.